Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think Donald just criticized me for preparing for this debate. And yes, I did. And you know what else I prepared for? I prepared to be president.
Look, it's all words, it's all sound bites. I built an unbelievable company, but I take advantage of the laws of the nation.
Good morning and good God. This is Paula Dix, a last-minute book report about the U.S. presidential election, coming to you on tape delay from two independent gambling armadas floating outside U.S. and New Zealand territorial waters. I am Jeb Lund, your co-host, and with me as last time is the illimitable Kiwi comic and raconteur, Tim Batt.
I'm so excited to hear where this language goes by the end of this short run of podcasts, Jeb. That was super impressive. A gambling armada? I love it. That's great. I feel like I'm in Macau.
That was my idea, is what I would like for every episode henceforth is that the read-on gets more tortured and interminable, and then the credits go.
Well, I'd like to think that for most people, we are the voice of the people. We are the vox populi. So it is that we're mirroring the mood of increasing despair and chaos leading into ultimate relief, and then we'll disappear. Much like the concerns of everyone. And after this first debate, which we've just watched, seems like we're on track.
Yeah, I mean, we're one third of the way there. I think the only things that happen are that they speak officially near each other three times, and then the election happens, and then that solves everything. I hope that's in the Constitution. I don't actually read it. I'm from the left. We pretty much just tear it up in strips.
You use it as toilet paper, as you use for the Constitution. Jeb, tell me about the conditions. Who were you with? What were you doing? How much did you have to drink?
I did none of that. I had to work, so I spent the afternoon pretty much at lunch. I turned on CNN and MSNBC and did a picture-in-picture and then skipped over to Fox a little bit. And then that stayed on for about 14 hours. And then at about 2 in the morning, I wrote a column and then filed it and went to sleep and then woke up 3 hours later. So it's...
Oh, man, my way was way more fun. I was by myself, but I was in my studio and I bought a 6-pack of beers. And I got through most of it, actually, during the course of the debate, which is terrifying. So by the end, I was reasonably sloshed. I had a bong on hand if things got really bad and a very sharp knife next to me if things got truly catastrophic as well. But I was pleasantly surprised. What a great debate. What a mass debate. I want to throw, first of all, some numbers before we get into the nitty gritty. 80.6 million people was the previous record. That was in 1980. That was the number to beat Jimmy Carter versus Ronald Reagan for their first and only presidential debate that they had. This one managed to get 84 million people, and that's just from the TV networks that were carrying it. So I think there's 13 different networks carrying it. So that doesn't include the internet streams, of which there were several million, or C-SPAN people. Of which there was probably ones and ones of viewers that didn't get put into that Nielsen final result.
Why does C-SPAN not count? And this is weird to me. Is it because it's run as a public trust so it doesn't get ratings?
Correct, yeah. Well, I'm guessing anyway, if it's the same sort of principles that we have in New Zealand, like our state broadcaster on the radio doesn't get counted in any of the radio surveys because there's no point. They're not selling ads, so they don't participate in it. So I'm guessing it's the same thing.
Oh, that makes sense. I was going to say, because I know a lot of people who watch it because it is relatively serene by comparison.
Yeah.
So if you can get like a network broadcast or a C-SPAN broadcast, I know a lot of people will do that just because on the C-SPAN broadcast, there won't be like
graphics everywhere.
You won't hear the president talk about, or somebody who wants to be the president talking about the hundreds of thousands of people they will maybe slaughter in the Middle East, and then a fade out, and then suddenly, I'm a Ford truck man. That's all I drive. And like, you're just, oh my God, why?
This is a bit much. This is a bit on the nose, CNN.
Yeah. So, and then people also, I noticed that last night too, was on Twitter, there were a lot of people encouraging, like, please go watch this on PBS and support your PBS affiliate, because that's the least obnoxious thing. Although in Patton Oswalt, I think, who is turned into a really peculiar political person, said something about how we need to watch it on PBS because everyone else enabled Donald Trump and they must pay. He's grieving. It's okay. He's grieving.
That's true. So look, I'll give some hot takes. I'm going to throw some hot takes at your face, Jeb, and then you'll likely either correct or more likely agree with me.
All right.
Firstly, I want to say Lester Holt did a great job. I was very impressed by his non-interventionalist approach. I know that he pissed off people on either side by being very quiet, particularly at the beginning of the debate. And all the Trump supporters were feeling butthurt because ultimately nothing really came up about Benghazi or the emails, which I think was the right call. Hillary did a great job of diffusing that when it came up, like the one time. Basically just said, yep, I absolutely goofed. I apologize for that. I own it. I'm not going to make any excuses. And you could count the beats because Trump didn't quite know where to go until he picked up that line of it was more than a mistake. It was purposeful. So that was nice. She handled it well. I thought Lester handled it well. And I just think he did such a great job. Didn't hear from him until he launched the tax return question. That was like the first peep you heard out of him from the night. And I said on Twitter that he was like a predator drone moderator.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. And I was actually going to ask you something because I had a certain American sports analogy. And this is, of course, an international broadcast. We are listened to in the country you live in and the country I live in, because that's where our moms are.
You can say New Zealand. It won't hurt you.
No, but I figure, you know, your listeners, I would like to ask for help with a soccer analogy, which, as you know, is what it should be called in the rest of the world. When he didn't intervene, I kind of thought that set the tone for, you know, these people can't eat into the allotted time by constantly appealing and going, Lester, 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 right? Because yeah. If you're the ref and you automatically just accede to, you know, they just immediately flop and, you know, like, oh, you know, Clinton stepped on my Achilles.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they go in and intervene right then they're stuck doing that for the whole night. And I thought it was sort of interesting because he allowed them to sort of hang themselves because.
Yes.
It can also be, you know, like the audience will notice if it's a form of rescue, if you just keep kind of whining and appealing to authority instead of digging yourself out of whatever hole there is.
That's absolutely true. And I think beyond that as well, you don't have a moderator in the room when you're the president, when you're talking to Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un or whomever. It was a good depiction of two people going at it, and you got to see, get a little taste of, you know, what they are like in these highly stressful and high pressure situations.
Yeah, although, I mean, the one thing I would say is that there's not as much grandstanding in those meetings, right? Because
of course, sure.
Yeah, there's not the audience there. But yeah, certainly, like, he can't, there isn't going to be an international body that he could appeal to, like, that Trump could appeal to as president to mediate being insulted by the German chancellor or, you know, the Chinese premier. You know, he can't just say, like, where, you know, he can bellyache at the U.S. media, but even then, there's no body above them that he can appeal to. So at best he sort of can go to his Twitter feed and hope that his fans abuse you know, the media or abuse his opponents, but he's not going to have that luxury with foreign leaders.
That's absolutely right. And I think at the risk of using a completely overused trope in this election cycle, Hillary Clinton came across from start to end looking super presidential.
I agree with that, but also I feel like the best take on that was from David Gregory, the former host of Meet the Press, when he said that she stayed within herself, which is like what everybody says about starting pitchers in Major League Baseball. You know, he didn't try to do too much. He didn't.
You're really leaning
game.
On the sports metaphors this time, Jeb. What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, that really happens in American sort of politics, and it just the let's relate it to football, which is related to war.
This is the sugar pill that you give your public so you can discuss politics in a public sphere.
Yeah, you know, so baseball becomes like a duel, or it becomes chess, you know, There are all the running analogies about exhaustion and endurance and stamina, like Trump said. So So he said she stayed within herself, which is, you know, she wasn't trying to throw too hard out there. You know, she knew her limits when she was out on the mound pitching. And then he said, she's a real steel magnolia. She looked presidential.
Beautiful. It's poetry. The word that I would use to describe her performance after I watched it was, it's in the neighborhood of constraint. I guess it is constraint. It's personal restraint. It's self-restraint. There were so many times when he was trying to bait her where she just didn't take the bait. And I was also particularly impressed with just, this seems like a weird thing to comment on, but we become so hyper aware of every element in television broadcast now. The composure of Hillary Clinton's face while Donald Trump was launching all these salvos, or just talking, just making his point. She managed to strike this balance of not looking disinterested or disengaged, but quite beautifully neutral. I mean, the quintessential example of how you can screw this up easily by a small thing is Al Gore in the first set of debate that he had against George W. Bush, when it got caught on mic that he was sighing during George W. Bush's answers, which a lot of people think turned off some of those down on the farm Texans and people like that who really value politeness to Al Gore. And she really stayed in it the whole time. It was impressive to just watch her face the entire time.
That was something that came through too earlier in the year when she, or I guess last year, I'm not sure what year did it happen in, the 11-hour Benghazi testimony.
Yeah, that she gave. That was this year. Yeah,
where and it the sort of impassivity, is if that's the right term, of her expression for most of it made the few times when she, like, either exhaustion or emotion got a little bit the better of her, or where she just sort of let something through because she wanted to, those became so expressive. So she had these little sort of exhausted smirks.
Mm.
But because they were happening at hour 7, 8, 9, the entire media and a lot of people just watching it recreationally had time to digest, like, what an exhausting and just sort of criminally stupid procedure this was. So what might have seemed gloating had it happened in the first 5 minutes, that little smirk when she, I think she was resting her chin in her hand.
Yeah.
Became,
yeah,
like this expression that almost everyone by that point shared. So it was as if she was giving permission to the audience, like, you can breathe. And that was very human and relatable and like
sort and of a great gif.
Yeah. But that was something similar happened last night where, you know, she's not responding to Trump, just increasingly going off the rails. And then, you know, at some point, you know, there, a couple times, some, you know, clearly she got an idea in her head and smiled a very genuine way. And, you know, her normal kind of on the stump smile is very forced and you know, that's what gets a lot of knocks from people of like, well, she's not sincere. But it's really hard to do that. I mean, there are very few people who can successfully do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Ted Cruz was the number two in the GOP, and there's not a single sincere feature to his face. So like when she actually seemed to be having fun, like, oh Lord, this is just too mirthful or whatever.
Yeah. And I mean, that
came through. So
the one that I think I've seen most people reference was the shimmy, the shoulder shimmy. There was an answer, and I wish I could remember offhand which question Trump was answering, but he kind of went from A to Z to B to Y to all over the shop. And then Lester Holt piped in and said, Hillary, your response. And she couldn't help but crack up a little bit. She gave this little shoulder shimmy and she said, okay, because this was a woman completely in her element. She, like, right from when she stepped out, she just looked so confident and happy to be there. She obviously was really well practiced, and everyone's been talking about how underprepared Donald Trump was. I've got like a theory about this, because everyone's was saying that he was underprepared. That was the message that was coming out of his camp. Now there were some other people who were saying that was just a campaign basically to throw the Clinton people so that they would get a bit of a false sense of confidence about the evening. And now people were going, oh no, he definitely didn't prepare. But here's the thing, Jeb, what if he did? What if he's actually spent the last week preparing incredibly hard and this was the result of that? No one's talking about that as a possibility, but I seriously think that's what might have happened.
It immediately made me flash on when Homer Simpson tries to save the bowling alley And it has a smash cut to him reading a book called Advanced Marketing, and he's got the little half moon spectacles on. Yeah. And then he gets frustrated, and it smash cuts to him reading Intermediate Marketing and the spectacles on. He goes, and then he goes to, like, you know, beginner's marketing. And then the last thing is him standing outside the bowling alley, firing off a shotgun into the air.
Yeah, absolutely. The last one that goes in the bin is Marketing for Dummies or something. That is kind of the perfect analogy. Because if you can imagine Kellyanne Conway just like locked in a room with a bunch of experts, and they're running through the trial runs. They've hired their mock Hillary Clinton to do the mock debates. They're in there for like a week solid, just sweating it out. And that was the result that we saw. I don't mean to be quite so glib or quite so glad, because I do really believe that for a job that's as important as leader of the free world, you need to have two really good people fighting for it at a minimum. Like, it doesn't serve anyone, the public included, when you've got one person who is vastly outclassed by another, because it really should be a competition of ideas and temperament and, you know, ability to communicate to the public a vision and to have that vision. And when one person comes so woefully inadequate, it's very fun to watch. It's been super entertaining, but ultimately that's not the best thing for everyone.
No, and it's not something that's the best for the Clinton campaign and a future Clinton administration either. I mean, I understand why Clinton supporters and Clinton workers and surrogates celebrated today. Look, they work really hard, and it's exhausting, and it can be depressing and a grind. So when they have these moments of victory, like, they're really going to give into it. But you know, what the campaign itself is doing is, you know, almost undermining, you know, its future too, because their argument is that Donald Trump is so unqualified to be president, so uniquely ignorant and ill-tempered, that there literally is no alternative. So when Clinton wins, right, you know, let's say, you know, it's a triumph over nothing, you know. So you've basically given yourself this, at best, grudging mandate, and you can't come in and say, listen, our ideas are ascendant, because you've actually paved the way for people are, you know, people are so afraid of this other thing. And that's such a low bar to clear. And it's one of those things that I wonder if they're just so anxious about winning this election that this strategy must be done above all. But, you know, there are all sorts of pitfalls to making Donald Trump so aberrant that Clinton has to win. And that's one of them. And the other being that by not focusing on the rest of the Republican Party and tying Donald Trump to the Republican Party and saying that he's a metastasis of the same disease that's running through all of these other people, what happens is she gets elected and all those other people that are there ready to oppose her, and they are untarnished. And in fact, Clinton's campaign itself has done a very good job of distinguishing them from Donald Trump. So she's not had a victory over them. She has no mandate over them. And, you know, especially when they celebrate kind of apostate Republicans who are endorsing her, the implication isn't we're endorsing her because we're rejecting the proposals of our own party. It's we're in rejecting Donald Trump, who is so uniquely horrible and outside the mainstream that once Clinton wins, he's no longer a problem and we can resume everything as before. The same sort of locked in opposition. And God, that's depressing.
It's a dark note. And I would like to take this opportunity before we go to a short break to bid a firm farewell to the three people who were staunch Republicans listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed your brief stay. Your coat is at the door. So we'll stop down for a moment, have a glass of water, and talk a little bit more about the debate and dig into some more specifics around it. Is that okay with you, Jeb?
Yes, please.
I do want to bring up the fact that you were the one that brought up the word super predator about young black youth. And that's a term that I think was it's been horribly met, as you know. I think you've apologized for it.
Welcome to the second of three parts of today's politics. Just a reminder to everyone as well, Jeb, I really want to paint a picture in people's minds of your situation right now. You've had, by the sounds of it, about 6 hours sleep in the last 48 hours, and it's 1 in the morning for you right now?
Yeah, it's 1:45.
That's fantastic. And I'm a dude from New Zealand who was watching the US presidential election first debate with about five beers under his belt within 120 minutes, which among my circles when I was a bit younger would have been deemed impressive. Now is just a little bit sad for a man my age. At any rate, as we continue to dig into the debate, Jeb, before we dig into some of the kind of more policy-driven parts of it, because we've talked a lot about the kind of look and feel of the thing, I just wanted to say that I now appreciate the benefit of not having Gary Johnson there. I kind of lamented the fact that he got left out. I can't remember exactly what his national polling was, but the threshold set at 15%, and I think he was above 10.
I think he was at 12.
12, right. Obviously, a lot of people are supporting third-party candidates this year because it's Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But being able to see Donald Trump just against one other person, and with the benefit of Lester Holt taking that back seat, and also with the additional benefit of the crowd not being able to make a peep, and Lester actually a couple of times silencing them when they did make a bit of a rise at something, was so cool.
He did the Roland Garros, quiet please.
Yeah, he did. Dad really, he chastised the kids for squeaking up, and it was such a cool thing because it took all of the regular Trump oxygen out of the room. And I think I noticed this right from the start of the debate, and it might be potentially because I've done a few years of stand-up comedy, that Trump demonstrably is a guy who is energized and powered on crowd approval. And seeing him right from the get-go, he looked de-energized in a room where no one could applaud. And I thought it was super interesting because if you take that into the White House, that's most of the time. I know there's a lot of media and a lot of events, but the actual job is being in a room and making decisions with a few other very intelligent people. And he really waned.
I completely, I understand your point about stand-up. I don't do stand-up, but I did, theater junk. And there's always that first minute adrenaline rush, like the fight or flight thing. And you're just, trying to kind of, making sure you're going through your material. And if you get a positive response, you feed on it and it becomes a virtuous cycle. And he seems to get that from the crowd. And he does kind of what pro wrestlers do, like they call it a cheap pop, where the guy comes out of the mic and says, "It's great to be here in Cleveland, Ohio," the crowd goes like, "Holy shit, Cleveland, that's where I live."
Yeah.
And, yeah, but if you don't kind of keep feeding that adrenal rush, you get the crash of like, well, I'm not in danger. I just need to curl up in the leaves here in the forest and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And he gets that really kind of somnolent quality. So many of the things that I've read about people who've done deals with him is that he does have a lower level version of that, where he seems to feed off of knowing the person in the room that he has to placate or bully or cajole or kind of tease to get a deal done. Like, he seems to have that preternatural capacity for singling out the one person who's capable of taking a no to a yes and making them feel like the center of attention and making them feel listened to, and then reading the note, the tone in the room, and then figuring out where to go next, where it's, bullying or, compliant. So many people have praised him from that on either side of the ideological kind of divide. So I think he might really be good at that. But you're right about like the TV thing and the policy thing. When you're speaking from the Oval Office, you don't have an audience. I don't know what he's going to do. Is he going to go out to, the Washington Redskins stadium and then, pardon me for using that term, by the way. I hope that doesn't, some people are probably listening to that and really upset about it, but,
change the name. So.
Yeah,
it is what it is.
But, he's not going to do the equivalent of going like, "Hello, Wembley," and then hearing the, watching people do the wave as he lays out.
Credit where it's due. I'm glad that you have acknowledged that. And you do have to keep reminding yourself, this is a very rich man who, yes, absolutely got a huge head start. But, he's still got all of his money. He obviously has a lot of intelligence in particular areas and a certain set of skills to do certain things. Does that qualify him to be president? We're No. about to find out if the American people agree with that or not. But it seems pretty clear from the first debate that's not really the right skill set that he has. But no, good on you for reminding us that he did get there somehow. He does have those skills.
I just want to see Donald Trump catch a break, you know, finally.
Can we just lay off the dude? Like, he's had a really hard time, a really rough life. He hasn't been dealt a good hand, and he's made the best of things with his paltry $1 million loan from his father and then obscene inheritance and whatnot, you know?
When he goes into Chick-fil-A, they don't let him bring his own gold toilet. You know, sometimes he's got to go on a throne that's, you know, a little bit lesser vintage or molding, whatever you want to call it.
Jeb, I want to ask you about a couple of the policy things that did come up. I've heard a bit of commentary of people being very, very disappointed that there wasn't enough policy discussion in there. Chuck Todd gave such bizarre immediate post-debate aftermath commentary. It was so confusing. He was saying, I'm sure a lot of Americans are going to be very disappointed with that debate, that there wasn't more policy, which I think was a complete misreading of it. And then you also made this incredibly daft comment on Twitter that got a lot of traction in a negative way, where he said Donald Trump appeared to come in underprepared, but Hillary Clinton appeared to be overprepared, to which the inevitable response from the internet was, yes, wouldn't it be terrible if we had a president who was overprepared for situations they were aware were coming?
This is a future segment. I mean, I think because I can do, you know, 5 minutes on this alone, but like the completely twisted doublethink that the, you know, the sort of beltway, you know, or the DC to New York elite media axis has to like tie themselves into to pretend they understand what real people care about is just fascinating.
Oh, it's like, that, and I think it's also just they everyone wants a close horse race because that's what sells newspapers ultimately, right?
This is actually another discussion. You know, I don't think anybody's, except maybe Fox, is willing to bend the ethics that hard to get that result. I mean, this is a close race. They have the most interesting candidate arguably in living memory.
It's a close race, but how did we get to that point? I guess is more my argument. Like, it's a close, I think it's a manufactured close race.
But anyway, I mean, like the larger point I just wanted to make, like, you know, the Chuck Todds of the world, they will see a very simple sort of like bit of data, you know, like this person said three bafflingly idiotic things. And then they, you know, maybe in a lot of cases, I don't even think it's like a macro view of, hey, how can we sell more airtime tomorrow or next week and keep people on the hook. It's like, it's, there are four people on this panel or eight and everybody has to have a take and nobody else has staked this out. Holy crap. I'm dying up here. I have to have an opinion. And, you know, somebody like Chuck Todd goes, you know, Americans really liked what, you know, Hillary Clinton said about enjoying burgers, but what if they enjoy turds? and then everybody can just,
tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, you know, maybe Heartland, you know, maybe actually like food is a really East Coast value, but people in the Heartland, they're people in Missouri and they just like to feed shit into their mouths.
I like any off-track discussion that devolves eventually to turds. It seems like the natural place to go. I want to ask you, though, about a couple of policy things, Jeb, because they did come up.
Yes.
Namely, the first one is stop and frisk, which I thought it was very interesting how it came up, because basically Donald Trump was asked about, and I can't remember the exact couching of this, but how he was relating to the black community and what he could do for African Americans and what he had kind of learned through the trail. And he brought up increased stop and frisk seemingly on a national scale. And on more than one occasion as well. This was an unforced, I would call it an error. It wasn't like he was prompted to say it or anything. And I haven't, has this been something he's been saying in the lead up to the debate as well? Because I thought this was kind of a new idea of his.
Yeah, it had been expressed in the previous week. And I think it's part of a larger phenomenon with Trump where I don't think he or anyone in his campaign, well, maybe he does because, you know, he's megalomaniacal, but I don't think anyone in his campaign actually thinks he's going to get a significant percentage of the black vote. So what he's doing when he says these things is this kind of palliative gesture that cloaks something that appeals to white voters in something right. that's supposed to seem color neutral. So he's saying, you know, to all the racists out there who think that black people are synonymous with crime. What he's saying is, I want to rescue these poor black people from themselves by weeding out the dangerous ones, because we know how many there are, right, from their community with stop and frisk. And I'm doing it for their benefit. And that allows the sort of, you know, I mean, he's still got his diehard voters, but let's say the undecided racists can say, people who, they like racism, but they don't really like what it says in the marketplace. So they want to like, they want him to seem not racist by reaching out to the black community so they can say, listen, this is a very generous man. He's trying to rescue these people from the Democrats again and from voting themselves into more crime and penury. But they were too stupid and worthless to listen to him, and they voted against their own interests anyway. You know, he's not a racist. I'm supporting him. And, the fact that black people don't like him is black people's fault. Boom.
Can you just, for a brief moment, Jeb, as well, for people who are listening who might not know, and I certainly am not an expert on it, but what is the whole stop and frisk thing about?
Well, it's part of broken windows policing, which was a theory that if you've read, I think, it's one of the Malcolm Gladwell books, the one before Blink, I think his first one.
Tipping Point?
Yes. So it was featured in The Tipping Point. Basically, the theory is, you know, you have these signals of decay in your neighborhood, broken windows, that give people an unconscious sense that the neighborhood is of no value. So they start to treat it poorly, and then, you know, more of a negative element moves in. But if you fix that and then you also bust all these minor infringements of the law, it will eventually roll up into bigger and bigger ones. So part of it was, you know, interdicting turnstile jumpers in the subway. Because if you arrest those guys, you put their fingerprints in the system. And then if they go commit a robbery later, you know who they are. Or maybe they've already committed a robbery and you arrest them for that and their fingerprints are in the system, so you get rid of them. So it's this sort of holistic approach to harassing people. And then part of that folded into that was stop and frisk, where you just sort of go intimidate citizens on the street. Or you go and you watch them until you feel that somebody has given you probable cause to demand that they open their, you know, empty their pockets and open their purses. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that, unsurprisingly, disproportionately targeted young African-American men, and then, you know, young other non-white young men.
Yeah, your race seemed to become probable cause at its worst bit, right? That was the issue.
So, and then, you know, what the right wing and a lot of the Democratic Party as well, to be fair, said was, you know, this worked. This did a great job because look how many, you know, the murders declined in New York. And look how, you know, look what a great success story they were. They had 2,500 murders or whatever, 2,200 that Trump cited in the debate stage, and they got it down to 500. Yeah. The problem is the crime rate went down everywhere in the United States. And it went down everywhere in the United States at the same time. And it began going down before that was the official policy of New York City. So there's really no correlation between it and this plummeting of the national crime rate. You know, New York went from Death Wish to, a Disney store in Times Square. So, that's the
which to borrow another author of some pop sci and pop psychology is from Freakonomics. Their theory on that was actually Roe v. Wade, that the fact that abortions became constitutionally protected meant that more unprepared mothers could end their pregnancies instead of having to give birth to a child in terrible conditions and then basically raise a bunch of criminals.
Yeah, and that article is still hugely problematic because they were...
I don't buy that, but anyway, stop and frisk keep coming up again in the evening, and there was a moment as well where Trump tried to pull that card of using the super predator comment, which Hillary Clinton made, what, in the early 90s or something?
96, I think.
Which has kind of been taken out of context and wielded by a lot of people kind of, yeah, in strange and unusual ways. If you look at the actual context around where she made the comment, she was saying that there is a minority of people, of young black men who are super predators, which was a terrible thing to say at the time. And I think Bernie Sanders even called her out on it in this election cycle and said it was a racist term. Everyone knew it was a racist term at the time. But what has happened since then is people like Donald Trump and some others on the right have been wielding it as if she was calling all young black men super predators, which is a pretty important conflation to correct when it comes up. But this was one of those things where I feel like he was trying to bait her into it, kind of getting into the weeds with her and getting into like a real close quarters combat scenario where they would just be burning up time. And it's like that old saying, right? Never fight a pig. Because you get dirty and the pig loves it.
Yes, and then the other corollary is if you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah.
And I think he was really hoping that she would suddenly go, you know, get that sort of stuttery Jimmy Stewart thing. No, you know, yeah. And then, like, you don't understand.
I mean,
understand.
I was so hammered at the time. And I can't even remember how she diffused that because I was a couple of sheets to the wind at that point. But it didn't seem to land nearly the impact that Trump wanted. Do you remember how that exchange wound up?
No, I think at that point I was deep in a K-hole and I had my head up against the speaker. No, I really do, I don't. I mean, my brain just started to fuzz out at certain points because you can't pay super close attention to these things without losing a minute or two here or there. I just remember sort of we were talking about it and then we were gone. And I was sort of astounded. And I think the way that worked was, she gave a very, I do remember it was a sort of brief response, but I think, Sanders backers and the Sanders, sort of insurrection in the Democratic primary insulated her from a lot of this because all of her voters have heard her explanations over and over. And I mean, unfortunately, the African-American community is kind of they're just sort of going to vote Democrat and Democrats know it. So they Clinton has made her apologies officially for it.
Yeah.
And she's had to explain her position before. And now I feel like she can just sort of nod to the audience and kind of go, this guy, he's trying to pull this again. You know me. And then they're in the camp. They're not going to go anywhere.
The one other thing I want to ask you about, though, which was interesting, which might have been one of the fuzzy bits where you zoned out, was there was a bit of back and forth on free trade, which was interesting because I think this is one where a lot of people can legitimize their love of Trump. And actually, a lot of commentators have noted that there's a similarity between policy-wise, what Trump's been saying and what Bernie Sanders was suggesting as well in terms of future American policy with regard to international trade. And NAFTA was one of the bits of legislation that came up, which was the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, for those who aren't American, there was an agreement between Canada, Mexico, and the US. Is that right, Jeb?
Yes.
Bill Clinton signed in, and I think
it was passed under H.W. Bush, and then Clinton signed it.
Yeah, right. And has it sort of been, would it be too broad to say that it's been universally accepted as being a bad thing for America in retrospect?
No, I mean, I think, what's interesting is that there aren't a lot of people who were talking about trade. That was such a consensus issue. I mean, even in the last election cycle, I mean, it is very odd that it's not odd. I mean, it makes sense that people are having the discussion, but it is so sudden that we're, the entire orthodoxy of free trade being great is now a bipartisan issue with the actual final two candidates.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you say that because it is and it isn't. And I think like this is when Donald Trump was having his best moments, actually, because Hillary Clinton does have a little bit of a nuanced position on this, which is hard to articulate. And it comes back to her comments previously on the TPP, where she was Secretary of State and she referred to it at one point as the gold standard of international trade agreements and has since walked that back to the point where I actually think she's removed stuff from the book, I don't know if you call them memoirs, that she put out, Tough Choices. I think in the versions that are coming out now, there's a section that's gone on that. But this is an area where Trump has been singing the same song since day one. And he has the benefit of not having been a politician that long. And Hillary Clinton's got far more of a murky and more nuanced both voting history and set of opinions and vision on free trade. So I think, like, yeah, this is the bit, I thought, in the debate where Trump was making his best points and making the best go of looking like there was a real reason for him being on the stage.
Yeah, and actually, let me clarify an earlier comment. You know, it was free trade was the orthodoxy for sure. The Republican Party, it has over the past several cycles been the orthodoxy of the final candidate from the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that sort of undermines Clinton's credibility is she and Obama went back and forth talking about the flaws in NAFTA in 2008.
Yeah,
and going off of that, you would think that they might have had a problem with it and pushed for legislation to amend it, and then it just disappeared. So people within the Democratic Party, or that kind of maybe very small rump of people in the Republican Party who wanted to talk about this, have seen the Democrats kind of, you know, just abandon it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's end that section there and have another brief break, Jeb, and we will come back with another short section to end on today.
I think I did a great job and a great service, even for the president, in getting him to produce his birth certificate.
Secretary Clinton.
Well, just listen to what you heard.
Welcome back to Politics, a podcast experiment and experience where one stand-up comedian from New Zealand is attempting to understand the 2016 presidential election and is joined by a Rolling Stone political journalist who is right now sleep-deprived to the point of hilarity. Hey, Jeb.
Hello, Tim. Thank you.
I like that I'm introducing each one of these segments as if a huge amount of time has passed, like potentially days, just to throw people off course so they're not quite sure how we've recorded these. But I like to keep people guessing. Two bits of hot topical news that is actually the same bit of news, Jeb. The Cincinnati Inquirer has just endorsed Hillary, which is significant because it's the first time they've backed a Democrat since 1916. And just for a bit of context, Obama won the state of Ohio in 2012, but only by 3%. So Ohio is, like, for our international listeners, one of the most important swing states, isn't it? Because it's very swingy and it's got a lot of delegates.
And I think at one point, and this is shame on me for not knowing my election year cliches, because there are, you know, like, as goes Ohio, so goes the nation, I think, because it accurately predicted for X number of years. But then there are always these things like if the Washington football team wins in the Sunday before Election Day, then the incumbent or the incumbent party wins. And then if the other team wins, then you get like either a new president or a new party.
Oh, yeah, and that stayed true
for a while, and then, of course, that's been wrong for two cycles at least, but people always say, like, it could come back.
And the other paper that endorsed Hillary Clinton in the last 24 hours is the Arizona Republic, who have never endorsed a Democrat in their 126-year history. So that's significant, and that's in a state where Obama lost in 2012 by 9% to Romney. So, I mean, that's even bigger. That's pretty huge.
Mm-hmm. Although, and this is something I don't want to pretend this is wholly an original insight by me, but anybody who's never read him, I really recommend him. Charles P. Pierce, a writer for Esquire. I think he goes, his Twitter handle is ESQ Politics. But he basically kind of has a recurring thing where he says, you know, I question the validity of newspaper endorsements anymore. And that wasn't something I'd thought of until I'd read him kind of banging away at that, you know, year after year. And, you know, like, I can look around and, you know, I have a liberal newspaper in nominally red state Florida, and I don't think it's, you know, it's always recommended the Democratic candidate in statewide office. And they haven't won one of them, I think, since I've lived here, except for the incumbent Bill Nelson, who just keeps winning.
I totally hear what you're saying. And the reason why I stick it on the podcast is not because I think it's going to lead people in a particular direction, but almost the opposite, that it's a weather vane for how dramatically different this election is compared to all others. And you're absolutely right. I don't think newspaper endorsements are doing, they're not leading anyone to take action anymore. But it is pretty amazing, these historic endorsements that are happening, and just goes to underline how different this election is from previous ones. And I'll tack on some numbers to that as well, that in Arizona, which is traditionally not a swing state at all, Trump is currently winning, and I'm just looking at the real Clear Politics average at the moment, he's winning by 1.6 points over Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Although put together they only equal 81, so that's a lot of third party. It's a lot of Gary Johnson, I'm guessing. Is that where he's from? Arizona?
Yes.
Did I imagine that? Yeah, right.
He was governor.
Yes.
We were talking earlier, I know, before the record, about...
Off air, we call it, in the biz.
Off air. Oh, that's right, yeah. Oh, I love it. It's great. It's fantastic. It's really good.
Were you being Trump for a brief moment? Is that the world's worst Trump impression?
No, it's like WKRP type guy. It's really good. I like it a lot. Thanks.
Oh, nice. Okay. Whenever I hear disjointed superlatives just wandering out there by themselves, my head will forevermore just go to Trump.
But one of the things that's always great about when they have the libertarian candidate in there is you always get those weird moments of sudden sense. And they're usually about foreign policy, because both parties have gotten, you know, the Republican Party has been hawkish as hell forever, and the Democratic Party, to seem serious about war, has just been, you know, getting increasingly hawkish since Vietnam and then 9/11. So you'll usually get that nugget moment when the Libertarian, and the one that always comes up for me is 2012, when you had all the Republican candidates saying, well, we're going to need to just bomb Iran. We're going to need to bomb Iran. You know, they're not a democratic people. They have no respect for democracy. And then crazy Uncle Ron Paul just hops in and goes, well, you know, they had a president and we deposed him.
Yep.
You know, if you didn't want the Iranian Revolution, why just set it up? You know, why did you back this repressive fuckhead, the Shah? And the Savak and torturing people.
I followed Ron Paul on that election as well. He was really chucking some stuff out there that no one else was talking about. He's a pretty cool guy. He is absolutely the proto Bernie Sanders of the, you call it of the right, don't you, really, if it's libertarian?
Yeah. And not to crib from Charlie Pierce again too hard, but he has a really great recurring line where he talks about Ron and Rand Paul, called the 5-minute rule, where, you know, you listen to them and they will say something so, you know, decent and insightful about your Fourth Amendment rights, or about you know, the unintended consequences of violent intervention in other nations. And for 3 minutes, it's sensible and wonderful. But at you know, I was at 5 minutes rather, and at 5 minutes and 1 second, they just
then
go
the
completely
Civil Rights
off the
Act
rails.
Comes up,
yeah, and then, yeah. It's suddenly like, listen, there's absolutely nothing that can go wrong from drinking, you know, the equivalent of a kilogram of silver in a colloid form.
I was going to say that, Jeb, before, you know, your boy Gary Johnson, because I'm now ascribing him to you, because you've got a hunger to have some libertarian views. He's so dovish, he doesn't even know where Aleppo is or what it is. So that's got to be on the very extreme end of the spectrum there, between bombing the crap out of Syria, which I assume John McCain would probably want to do if he was in this cycle, and not knowing where Aleppo is. Those are the two ends of this football field.
I did hear a fun theory, and somebody, if you go back and you watch the audio of it, you can totally get, I mean, it's very plausible that he thought somebody was saying a, like, not Aleppo, but like a Aleppo, like one Aleppo.
Sure.
And that maybe he's just thinking, what the fuck is a Aleppo? Like, and yeah. I mean, I'm willing to grant him that much, because aside from Hillary Clinton, I have no confidence that really anybody else, like, you know, in this race, or certainly in the Republican Party, has a very clear idea of who's in Syria. Like, if you told them that the Hmong people are, you know, close to weaponizing, you know, biological agents in Syria, they'd be like, oh, yeah, fantastic. And then you could show them, you know, like actual Hmong citizen. And anyway.
Going to wrap up on that depressing note of shallowness in the field of international, it's not like I know, but then it's not my job to know. It is some politician's job to know. Anyway, to leave on, 538, the polls only forecast at the moment has got Hillary Clinton at 55.5 and Donald Trump at 44. So that kind of shows what a massive change a debate can make.
Well, you know, the thing, the 538 poll, I'm not going to get very, I'm not sold on that. And I'm not trying to terrify all the, you know, Democratic listeners out there and comfort our millions and millions of right-wing fans on here. But if you look at what Trump said in the debate, and this is something that I believe Corey Robin, I'm never really sure how it's pronounced, pointed out, like what Trump was actually offering apart from, you know, his heterodoxy on trade was the standard conservative candidate plank. I mean, that if you look at the positions that he articulated during the debate, that's regular conservative. And
yeah,
I would not be surprised to see that, you know, you're going to get a spike after the debate and then the memory is going to fade and we're going to resettle in again in where the Democrats should be demographically and mm-hmm. where the Republicans should be demographically. And, you know, apart from the histrionics of Donald Trump, from day to day, when he's been doing these sort of policy events, he's been getting a lot closer to saying, I am the Trumpy version. I am the huge version of a candidate and a platform that you're very familiar with. And so all this kind of, yeah, I mean, you'll get a spike like this after a debate occasionally. I think, you know, we've got 44 days to go and
sure,
people will,
yeah.
you know, people are going to forget. A lot of people, not, you know, some people won't, this dunking
yeah.
moment, and they'll, you know, kind of, I think, you know, we'll see them resume their roles.
Until we have the second debate, which is on October the 4th. Hey, Jeb, I've just had this idea now. It's just struck me. The reason why you know who I am is because I do a podcast with my friend Guy, and the podcast is called The Worst Idea of All Time, where we watch the same movie every week for a year and keep reviewing it. And we have a segment in that called The Shining Light, where we try and find something good about the movie that we haven't mentioned previously for that week, to be positive. So I would like to mm-hmm. end the episode with something that you thought Trump did well at the debate, and I'll attempt to articulate one as well.
Huh.
And I don't mind going first to buy you some time.
Yeah, I hadn't thought to focus
mine's
on that, but yeah.
Mine's very broad, which may fuck you, but I'm going to do it anyway because I can't think of another one. But
somebody's got to do it.
That's right. In terms of an actual crap the bed moment, which I was definitely expecting, and I think a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters were expecting as well, I don't think that was there. Like a 6-second clip of him flying off the handle with anger, it was again a lot of little things, a lot of interjections. There's been a lot of talk about the interruptions that that he had, but I don't think that there was that moment of him completely flying off the handle. And for that, with the low bar we have set for Donald Trump, he gets a thumbs up from me.
All right, you bought me some time. And that's a good one, by the way. Not the buying time, your shining light. My shining light, I think, is at the very end, like right after the debate, when they asked if he anticipated disputing the results of the election. And he, you know, and, or no, that was in the debate. And he
yeah.
said no. And then when he was asked again afterward, he said no. And there was this is really hard to explain. And I'm going to get into some of the armchair psychoanalyzing that I really dislike from other people. Garrison Keillor did it, and people were overjoyed at the column he wrote. And it really seemed to be psych 101, like, you're compensating for this, you know, and just this really kind of boilerplate stuff. But up until this point, Trump hasn't had to face off against anybody he actually respects. And, you know, he has been the alpha dog in every room he's walked into up until this point. And by the end of that, like, you know, he did not seem like that. He did seem beaten. And, you know, I think, like, on one level, he definitely has respect for Hillary Clinton just because of the insane resume that she has. I mean, it is a peerless resume. But she did dominate him. And, you know, he went back to this weird, like, oh, okay, well, you know, sure, we'll see what happens. But yeah, we'll do it. And look, I mean, this could be falsely clutching at some shred of humanity in him. Like, you know, the thing, the weird sort of anthropomorphized rag that's screaming on the floor of the White Room in the last Harry Potter movie when he sees, like, what's left of the soul of Voldemort in the afterlife, right? But maybe I'm just looking for that. But, you know, maybe when this is all over, and he has to he can resume being whatever his version of normal. You know, he'll go back to being that person who can be a civil, you know, and gracious human being around somebody that he can view as, you know, worthy. And I don't know if that's just, I don't know, it's probably a complete illusion, but just seeing that moment of like, oh,
just
yeah,
own
no,
it,
I'll,
man. Just I'll, give I'll, him I'll, this. Give him yeah. this one thing that he was able to accept the outcome of an election. I don't think that's too much to give to the man.
Yeah, this country has been here for over 200 years, and he was willing to suggest that he was on board with perpetuating it.
There you go. And on that wonderful vision of sunlight, we will end this edition of Politics. Jeb, thank you so much for staying up, and you shouldn't be awake right now, so I hope no. whatever you need to do to get to sleep, you can figure that out.
Thank you. Thank you. And likewise, I assume, I don't know much about the time change, but I assume in New Zealand it's about 3 months past the US election already, and I just hope it looks beautiful.
Yeah, I don't want to give you the outcome because it spoils it for you guys in America, but we know what's up, and we're feeling okay. Let me just say that.
Thank God.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.